The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Friday, July 21st, 2017, from Slate. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Spicer, out. It was all his fault, which is weird. I mean, he's not the guy who met with the Russians, who fired the FBI director, who admitted to Lester Holt why he fired the FBI director, who tweeted about Mika's face. He's not the guy who failed to learn what a risk pool or any other healthcare policy term meant. He's not the guy who failed to sign a major piece of legislation. But I guess the problem was he didn't really spin any of those things into glory, did he? And also his suit was ill-fitting, that first day suit. He also said Hitler never gassed anyone, when what you're supposed to say about Hitler is that he got defeated by the Russians in the cold. Also, he's not a woman. Trump thinks a woman should be a spokesman. Blaming Spicer is like blaming the waitress at the International House of Poop Sandwiches. Like, excuse me, this sandwich, it's weird. It kind of tastes like poop. We also have news that the White House has appointed, not as the guy at the podium, but the guy behind the guy at the podium, Anthony Scaramucci, a Wall Street investor who ran into confirmation trouble for his proposed first job, director of the Office of Public Engagement and Intergovernmental Affairs. That was the post held by Valerie Jarrett under Obama. So it's supposed to be a very high post. Since then, his name has been floated maybe to have a job at the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development or a role in the Export-Import Bank. It's been said that there's a sale of his company going on, and it was hard to square that with disclosure requirements. It's also been reported that Reince Priebus simply didn't want him in the White House. But since he hasn't been in the White House, he has had plenty of time to go on TV to be a Trump surrogate. Let's look at this appearance on MSNBC, where he asserted that Trump was a great communicator, and a fellow panelist, maybe you could discern the voice, took issue with that.
I don't think someone who set the records for lying can be called a good communicator. I think he's great to his base, but when you are as dishonest as he is, that is by definition not being a good communicator. He's good to the people who want to hear his message. He's done nothing to ever convince someone who's on the fence.
Michael.
Mm-hmm.
I know you guys are upset about it.
Please stop saying you guys. It doesn't matter. It's not about you guys.
Look 2 days ago, he tweeted at the table, him Stephanie. Giving look himself. Look at the reaction. He's Anthony, calling. Michael's calling ago. Him a liar.
In that conversation, Scaramucci also cited Donald Trump's exceptional neuroplasticity. That means the ability of the brain to change and develop new pathways to cognition. Turns out every human being has neuroplasticity. 71-year-olds have it in declining amounts. And I think Trump's last interview with the New York Times, where he flitted from topic to topic like a common housefly at the aforementioned International House of Poop Sandwiches, that might indicate that the bold assertion about Donald Trump, his neuroplasticity, a bold assertion about his virtue, is really just desperate spin that underlines a gaping flaw. This happens quite a bit. See, also, I think my strongest asset, maybe by far, is my temperament. I have a winning temperament, or the promise that the inauguration would have a soft sensuality and a poetic cadence, or this statement from the woman who will be replacing Spicer permanently and answering to Scaramucci.
No, I can definitively say the president's not a liar.
On the show today, I spiel about climate change messaging and getting through to the holdouts. Why that? Well, because first, I talked to Al Gore about the new sequel for An Inconvenient Truth. And I want you to know we had this conversation off-site, but in a conference room with no air conditioning. We turned the air conditioning off, I swear. Here's Al Gore. The most common complaint about a sequel is that there's no real need for it to be made. Jaws died, Marty came back from the future, what's the problem? Standing in stark contrast to this complaint is An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. When Al Gore made the first film in 2006, yes, it won an Oscar, helped him secure part of a Nobel Prize, it won converts. But did it win over enough members of the public to change minds? When you think about it, that is a tall, tall order for a movie. Even the most popular movies of all time aren't seen by most of the populace. They're not asked to change enough minds to enact policy. So here, talking to me, is Al Gore. We're going to talk about the science, the sequel, and changing minds. Hello, how are you?
Hi, fine. Thanks for having me.
So my first question, was not going to be the most relevant one, but in the scene in the movie, when you are sitting at your desk as vice president and the earth is behind you, are you wearing a calculator watch?
Yeah. It's one of those old Casio watches. You're the second person to ask me about that. I can't believe that caught your eye. Yeah. No, I'm...
Well, the glaciers made a little more of an impression, but that was a detail that stood out.
I'm kind of an early adopter, I have to admit.
So... this movie is a great movie, and part of it is it has great visuals, but it is kind of a shame that so many of these breathtaking visuals are there because, say, the planet is melting.
Yeah, we're doing a lot of damage. We're putting 110 million tons of man-made global warming pollution up into the sky every day, as if it's an open sewer. And the accumulated amount is trapping an enormous amount of heat energy, most of it going into the oceans. It's melting the ice, it's making the air temperatures much warmer, disrupting the water cycle, making the droughts longer, making the downpours and floods bigger, moving tropical diseases poleward, and the list goes on, unfortunately. And since the last movie came out, these climate-related extreme weather events have become a lot more common, a lot more destructive. Superstorm Sandy in New York City is a good example from the U.S. But we've had 11 once-in-a-thousand-year events just in the last 7 years. So, yeah, they're getting worse. But the good news is there's another big change in the last decade. Now we've got the solutions.
From a movie perspective, this has, you document the change. You're very convincing. You buttress your arguments with facts and charts. But at the same time, it has to work as a movie. And so from a dramatic perspective, it's sort of built around the question, the conflict of the Paris Accords. Will you get the Indians to come on board? Can you leverage your contacts in private industry? And it works, and it's triumphant. But then, of course, Donald Trump pulls out of it. And so I'm thinking it's like watching Die Hard and John McClane gets all the people out of the building and then boom, a bus comes along and kills them all. So how, you know, how much does that ruin, affect the viewing experience of the movie, what Donald Trump has done?
Well, in this case, to twist your metaphor around, the people stop the bus and take over and start driving it. And what I mean by that plot twist is that since Donald Trump made his announcement that he was going to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement, the American people have said, no, you don't, not so fast. And a lot of the governors and mayors and business leaders have all said, we're still in the Paris Agreement. And the latest figures show that the U.S. is likely to meet our commitments under Paris, regardless of what Donald Trump says.
So how much, at the same time, we still desperately need both parties to more or less, and they don't have to be in lockstep, but to more or less agree this is a problem, agree that there is a human cause, and agree that government has at least some of the solutions. So absent that, can we ever really make power if one of the two political parties in the United States is just a no vote on all of this?
Well, that sure makes it harder. It's odd, you know, for the U.S. to have this phenomenon. It's the only country in the world where the conservative political party is dedicated to climate denial. And of course, our democracy has long since been hacked by big money and the contributions and lobbying on the part of the carbon polluters are largely responsible for what's gone on, most of all in the Republican Party. Some Democrats have fallen prey to it as well, but most haven't. And in my home state of Tennessee, there's an old saying, if you see a turtle on a fence post, you can be pretty sure it didn't get there by itself. And in this case, you can be pretty sure this climate denial didn't get there by itself. The carbon polluters have not only concentrated on the politicians and the office holders, they've spent more than $1 billion in putting out false narratives and pseudoscience, and they took a page from the playbook. They took the whole playbook from the tobacco companies back when the scientific consensus linked cigarettes to lung cancer. They hired actors and dressed them up as doctors and put them in front of cameras and teleprompters to say, hi, there aren't any health problems at all with smoking. I'm a doctor and I smoke myself. And they're doing the same thing with carbon pollution. Now, luckily, there are some Republicans breaking ranks now. There's a so-called Noah's Ark caucus in the Congress today, which is pretty cool. They have to join two by two, one Democrat, one Republican. And a small but growing number of Republicans are saying, hey, this is crazy. We can't stick with this nonsensical, destructive position.
Well, I wanted to ask you about tobacco because I don't know. Well, I've never heard you talk about this. In you, the Clinton-Gore administration had very excellent policies on tobacco. And I remember in 96, you talked about your sister and how she died from the effects of smoking. And of course, I mean, we see the family farm in this, and your dad farmed tobacco. And you did a little bit, right, when you were
a
kid?
When I was a kid, I worked in the tobacco fields in the summer. Sure did.
So here's my question. You weren't wrong on that issue. Maybe you were a little late, but it seems to me there are so many parallels. You just made one, the climate denialism. And I'm wondering if not being as perfect as you could have been on the tobacco issue, just because of your family legacy, in any way influenced your stance on this, the immediacy of wanting to get our current public health issue correct.
Well, it's an interesting question. Hadn't thought of it in that context, but maybe once you go through something like that, it kind of leaves a pretty deep impression on you. And, you know, I've got four kids, four grandkids. You naturally think about an issue like climate through the impact that's going to have on them. Of course, it's having an impact on us right now. But yeah, I guess that experience did kind of sensitize me to the need to really keep what's most important foremost in mind.
Well, also, you were dealing with constituents of yours who up in Northern Cumberland, right, region, so many tobacco farms, probably just like coal miners or people in Appalachia today are saying, this is my livelihood, even when it might not be, even if you can counter that with logic and say, well, green can replace coal. You know about how to connect to the emotion of that as well as the intellect.
Yeah, that's true. I remember having town hall meetings in a lot of counties in my congressional district explaining why I was going to go after the tobacco companies for not having warnings and trying to fool people on it. And, you know, I found that when you feel strongly about something and it's morally and ethically based and you're willing to stand up and stick to your guns and fight for your position, people respect you for that.
Well, maybe. I would like to think that's true. But this was, I mean, you were a representative when? From like 75 to 81?
76 through 84, 77 through 85 in the House,
right.
and then 85 through 93 in the Senate.
I think politics were different then. I mean, I think that the force of an argument and marshaling logic had, just because of ideological sorting and other factors and, you know, weaponized denialism campaigns, these things didn't exist back then. It might have been easier then. I mean, your power as a arguer, as a prophet, might have been forged at a time when some of those techniques were more useful than they are now.
Well, I think you make a good point. And in fact, I watched this change take place during my career in government. And a lot of it had to do with the rising dominance of television in those years and the emergence of the 30-second TV commercial as the main currency of politics. It's beginning to change a little bit now with the internet, but not all that much.
And that's all for the better, by the way.
Not all for the better. We'll have to see how it sorts out. But when the television ad was the dominant medium, that required members of Congress to spend most of their time begging rich people and special interests for money. And that, I think, really gave a lot of influence to the lobbyists and the special interests who were all too eager to provide that money. That's the big change that I saw. But I would phrase it a little bit differently. I think the threshold you have to clear in order to promote the public interest is higher now because money has more influence, but you can still clear it. You can still make the case. And we're winning the case on the climate crisis. People are coming around. We are going to win this.
Has your messaging changed since 2006? Have any of the studies on cognition and argument, there are whole centers for explaining science and climate. Yeah. Has that affected how you craft the message?
Yeah, definitely. There's a major cottage industry now in climate denial. And so there's a major scientific study of climate denial, and I've been through most of it, and I've gotten to know a lot of behavioral psychologists and neuroscientists who specialize in this stuff. I don't claim particular expertise in this, but I will tell you one big change that I have made in my efforts to communicate about it. It's driven by the changing facts on the ground, but I always make a point to emphasize the hope in this. And the hope is legitimate. It's not a put on in any way, shape, or form. But over the last decade, we have seen a truly historic, dramatic drop in the price of electricity from solar, electricity from wind. The cost of batteries is now chasing them down the cost curve. Efficiency technologies of all kinds, they don't have the same kind of sex appeal, I guess, but taken together, they're a huge factor. And we've now decoupled economic growth from emissions. The global emissions have now flattened out for 3 years in a row. We need to bring them down. We can't keep adding all this stuff every day. But it's now clear that we are in the early stages of a global sustainability revolution that has the magnitude of the Industrial Revolution, but the speed of the digital revolution. And it is making every business and industry more efficient. It's helping homeowners as well. And it drives solutions to the climate crisis.
The proof of the pudding's in the taste. It's right there in the documentary. There's a lot of hope. There is a chart that gets maybe more applause than anything else with,
Chile.
Chile is adding solar capacity. But I'm thinking more of convincing the people who haven't come along. There are studies that actually show pretty demonstrably that the more informed a conservative thinker is on this issue, the more he believes in climate denialism. So the old way of thinking of it is arm people with the facts and they'll come along. I think the new way of thinking of it, and that's called the, you know, more information hypothesis. If you give people more information, they'll get smarter. But there's a whole new way of thinking of it, which is we have just such tribal identities that doesn't penetrate. We've got to try other rhetorical techniques. And so my question is, are you up on the social science of rhetoric as much as you or cognition as much as you are on the climate side?
Yeah, well, I try to be. You can't be an expert in everything, and I don't claim to be an expert in much of anything, but I have tried to understand the social science, and I'm familiar with the studies you're talking about. They're a little bit depressing, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, yeah.
But what I find is that people who put up their dukes and want to fight when you make it all about the information are actually susceptible to arguments that are based on a moral appeal.
The research does show that, in fact, and the more people identify as like evangelical Christian or Catholics, much more likely to come along on the climate.
Yeah, and there is a new participant in this debate, Mother Nature, and she has a pretty persuasive voice. Every night on the TV news now is like a nature hike through the Book of Revelation, and even people who don't like the phrase global warming or climate crisis are beginning to say, something weird is going on here and it's not good. There's a new book called, Farmer, Rancher, Fisherman or something like that. And it's one of many new works that are documenting the fact that people who are in contact with nature in their jobs, people who pay attention to nature in their lives, are really noticing these big changes. And what I see, the way I see the climate movement is in the context of the other great moral changes that have advanced humanity, the effort to abolish slavery, the abolition movement, the women's suffrage movement, the civil rights movement in the South, which I saw close up as a kid in Tennessee the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, more recently the gay rights movement in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world. And in every case, you had the same kind of ferocious, unyielding opposition. And ultimately, when the issue was resolved into a binary choice between right and wrong, then all of a sudden, it was like a dam breaks loose and the change comes rushing on. If somebody told me 5 years ago that marriage equality would be the law of, in all 50 states in the U.S., and two-thirds of the American people would accept and even celebrate gay marriage, I would have said, well, I hope so, but I don't know what you're smoking, because that seems awfully unlikely. But it did happen because it became resolved into a choice between right and wrong. That's the point I think the climate movement is at right now.
Al Gore, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now the spiel. So that was my talk to Al Gore. His movie was A Call to Arms. At the very least, you'd have to allow that it's quite convincing, provided you possess one quality. That quality being that you are convinced to begin with. Sadly, that is what a lot of the data shows. Now, I do really believe that Al Gore is something of a prophet. His name has long been associated with environmental issues. In fact, to detractors, like the now all but sainted George H.W. Bush, an environmental concern was Al Gore's name.
Governor Clinton and the ozone man, all they do is talk. All they do is. Hey, listen, put ozone in there and every worker is going to depends on reasonable balance between the environment and growth and business is going to be out of work. I'm a good environmental president, but we're not going to go to the extreme under Clinton and ozone.
Yeah, well, who's right now? Polls show that 64% of Americans are worried, at least to some extent, about global warming. That number is rising gradually. I hope it's rising as gradually as the sea. And the number also swells among the young. But so many people still deny climate change. Enough for American policy to officially have turned its back on science and participation in a vital treaty. Here are some other discomforting studies. Pew asked Americans, agree or disagree, climate scientists can be trusted a lot to give full and accurate info on causes of climate change. Overall, only 39% of Americans agreed with that statement. Only 36% of Americans are personally concerned about climate issues. And a Yale poll from a few months ago shows that fewer than 40% of Americans believe climate change will, quote, harm me personally. It might seem churlish or picky to criticize the most effective voice on climate issues for not being as maximally effective as he could be. But look at what the best social science says about ways to communicate the hard science of global warming. There's a lot of researchers who've done great work into the social science. Daniel Kahneman is great. Per Espen Stokens, author of What We Think When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming, is also good. I'll play a clip of him. In this clip, he's on the You Are Not So Smart podcast, which I highly recommend. It is about thinking and self-delusion.
If you have a problem, you try harder the way you have tried to solve it. But then gradually, what you do is by pushing harder and harder, you're just reinforcing the problem because you're doing something that also contributes to the problem. And this has been the case in terms of climate science communications, because there has been this conviction that if only we could get the facts out to people, then they would kind of come to their minds and senses and recognize that this is important or this is serious. However, having tried that and seen that it didn't have the intended effect, what has the climate science communicators done? Well, they're doubled their efforts.
In the first Inconvenient Truth, and for a few years right afterwards, an accurate and compelling point was that there were more and more studies showing scientists coming to the same conclusion. Either all the studies or almost all the studies said this. The communicators took these top-notch studies and organized around this message, the message being you need to know there is massive consensus among the experts. Thousands of articles were written mentioning this consensus. Prominent voices chimed in. Maybe you could recognize some of these guys.
97% of scientists, including, by the way, some who originally disputed the data, have now put that to rest. They've acknowledged the planet is warming and human activity is contributing to it.
A survey of thousands of scientific papers that took a position on climate change found that 97% endorsed the position that humans are causing global warming.
Some 97% of scientists who have written in peer-reviewed journals say the following: climate change is real, it is significantly caused by human activity.
The kicker is this. It's not that they were wrong. It's that they were ineffective. The message, the accurate, compelling, dire message, had little to no effect. Pew asked recently, do you believe that almost all climate scientists agree that human behavior is mostly responsible for climate change? Only 27% of Americans thought that was the case. And if you look at just the basic line, the percent of Americans who worry about global warming a great deal, from 2006, the year of Al Gore's first documentary, to 2016, it went from 41% worried a great deal to 37% worried a great deal. There are a lot of things that go into this disappointing result, and global cooling isn't one of those things. But it seems clear that some messages reach the people and some don't. And it's a rare message that reach the people who aren't already on board. I've spent a fair amount of time on how to convince global warming skeptics. Some are unreachable. You got to know that. You can't get to everyone. But most are only unreachable if you keep using the same methods of asking them to default and defer to the expertise of scientists, or you keep showing them pictures of polar bears or people in the Philippines, or if you keep using phrases like 2 degrees Celsius rise by the year 2100. And one big reason why Al Gore's message isn't getting through to those not already galvanized is this. It's Al Gore saying it. This is Jay Heinrichs. He's the author of Thank You for Arguing, What Aristotle, Lincoln, and Homer Simpson Can Teach Us About the Art of Persuasion, speaking recently on WNPR's Colin McEnroe Show.
One problem with climate change is before Al Gore became the spokesman from the left to inform everybody of the problem, a majority of Republicans believed in climate change and believed that humans caused it. What Gore did, through no fault of his own, by the way, was to drive people into belief as a form of identity. And once belief becomes part of your identity, I'm a good patriotic American, therefore I can't believe in this or I must believe in this, you're really not going to be able to settle anything from a conversation.
Now, Heinrichs went on to note that he's not faulting Al Gore. Like I said, Al Gore is a prophet, but listen to what Per Espen Stoknes says.
When you hear some expert talking, then we typically want to know a little bit about what's his identity. Is he in my tribe, so to speak, or is he from somewhere else? And studies have been done that show if the expert holds the same values, for instance, religious or in terms of politics, then I tend to trust that expert more, even if it's a fake expert.
So what should Al Gore do? Should he shut up? Well, did William Lloyd Garrison shut up? Did MLK? Did Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah, or Daniel? No. First of all, Al Gore has clearly studied some of the latest scholarship on communication, or at least what it says and recommends happens to align with how he likes to give out his message. There is ample research advising against the gloom and doom message. You have to give people hope, otherwise they find it off-putting. And as you heard, Al Gore is very empowering. He's very optimistic. And I'm also a believer in letting a passionate, accurate voice do his thing. Be passionate and accurate. Be the best Al Gore you could be. Too many political consultants with studies about messaging have ruined Al Gore in the past as he sought office. Let's not do that to him in this unelected position, which might be the most important thing he's done. It's good, I think, for Al Gore to be one front in this argument, to allow others to head up outreach to the as yet unconvinced. And it's not as if there's no value in rallying the troops, exciting the base, and making good, compelling documentaries that succeed as such. You know, we say preaching to the choir as if that's nothing. It ain't nothing. A good preacher is a glorious thing. Preacher is a job, and it's not an easy one, nor is prophet. Now, I've called Al Gore a prophet 3 times, I think. But remember that the prophets of the Old Testament weren't always listened to either. There's a part in the Bible where the Lord is essentially complaining to his prophet, Jeremiah. He's saying, I sent them, you, with my word, but do they listen? They do not. Here's the part. They hearken not unto me, nor incline their ear, but harden their neck, and they did worse than their fathers. And with that, God promised destruction if the warnings he sent forth were still ignored. There is a message in that too. That's it for today's show. Just producer Chris Berube doesn't believe in the overwhelming consensus that Die Hard is a Christmas movie. Just producer Mary Wilson has found a peer-reviewed double-blind study that indicates that a hot dog is a sandwich, but also not a sandwich at the same time. Steve Lickteig, executive producer of Slate Podcast, believes that at the current rate of glacier retreat and sea level rising, Sean Spicer will be doing a commercial for pistachios within 3 months. The Gist, embodying all the best practices of neuroplasticity ever since we gained consciousness. Oompuru, depuru, dupuru, and thanks for listening.